I will make a couple of shameless plugs, and I can't help but doing that. Okay. My name is Marlene Tapia. I'm at Minnesota State University, Mankato. This project couldn't have happened, though, without Kristen Ohls at the Indiana Department of Ed. Kristen, if you have any questions about doing this online, her, not me, ask Kristen. But Kristen has just been wonderful, and I can't help but thank her enough. And then Susie Crouch, and I'll come back to the fact that she's at Ball State rather than Indiana Department of Ed at the end. I will make one kind of shameless plug here. This is the School Health Education and Services section. The other day at the Governing Council, I noticed they left to the two people that really were instrumental in the session, were not in this section, were not put on the list, but they did make it on yesterday. We made a visit to the office, but one is Peter Cortese. Peter was at the Centers for Disease Control for many, many years. For those of you that are students in the room, and this is one of my shameless plugs, because of I've had many wonderful opportunities in my career, but part of them came because Peter was such a wonderful mentor to me, and so I have to acknowledge Peter's passing. And then some of you, Hal Venker also recently passed, and he was a member of this section as well. He's probably more well-known for his students, John Seffrin, the chief CEO of the American Cancer Society, Mohammed Tarabi, but I can't do this without them. I did forget one person, though, and that's Elena Slepcevich. And so my other shameless plug is that for those of you that are in school health and services and want to become involved, they meet tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock in the Del Mar Room. The other thing is to get to know people in both school health ed and services and PHEHP, Public Health Education Health Promotion. The social is tonight in rooms 4 in the convention center at 6:30. So please become involved because, again, I can't thank some of the people that have done things for me along the way. Coordinated school health program, you're probably well familiar with. I'm not going to spend any time on it. And certainly the importance of it are probably clear by a couple of my cartoons. And I often say to my students, we have funny cartoons and then we have some that aren't so funny. And this is one of those that isn't so funny. You know, and certainly we've seen some of the federal policy and certainly the measuring of that policy through SHIPS and the work of Jamie and Carrie. And certainly one of the documents that came out about 10 years ago, the IOM, one of their things was to have school health coordinating councils at the district level. And one of the really neat things that happened in Indiana was the passage of Senate Bill 111, which required the formation of school health councils at the local level in each corporation. They have corporations in Indiana instead of districts, but to do that. And so the goal of this project was to begin to watch what was happening in Indiana schools relative to the passage of Senate Bill 111. One of the things I'm going to caution you about is my ends change. I certainly don't have the power of the numbers that Sarah had or that they have, and so I don't want to overstate my data either, but do watch the ends change because of where people are at in implementing things. But I think it's kind of fun to see some of the stuff that we did find. I had one very excited phone call back to Indiana once. I said, you're not going to believe what's in this data. The questionnaire, I'm not going to spend much time on it, but it went through a variety of types of information related to it. Just some background information about who in Indiana they designated as the healthy school point of contact. They're the person that gets all of the information related to coordinated school health programs and to disseminate it out through their schools. We also looked at the training of the people involved, and there's some interesting things there, I think. What about the infrastructure for coordinated school health programs within their school district, as well as the structure, function, and activities, and documentation of some of the things they do? And then finally, some of their perceptions on Likert scales. You'll see later on, I really do know my statistics, and so although, well, how the devil did she make that correlation? What I did do is combine some of these items into scales, and so I didn't really violate statistical, assumptions here. Okay. So again, the participants were healthy school point of contacts in Indiana. And so as of August 2007, we had 249 of the 293 school corporations in the state identified. And again, Kristen sent an original and two emails asking them to participate in an online survey. And again, with that was included their consent, etc. Some of the statistics, and I don't have slides related to each of these procedures, and so this is what was run on the data. I don't have all of these, so although you're going to say, well, where was that? It's not in here. Okay. Response rate, really quite cool. Really, you know, pretty neat for this. But again, notice one of the things is you'll see that my numbers will shift, and that part of it is because some of these schools have not put into place any activities at that time related to coordinated school health advisory councils. And so that's why you're going to see a shift from the big numbers to the little number. Okay. Just who they are. And the part about this that really kind of bothered me as a health educator is that there were very few people. Well, notice health educator isn't on that list, but lots of school nurses. And so when anybody starts complaining about school nurses, I start singing about them, because for me, school nurses have really been an important partner in coordinated school health, and that's my experience in a variety of different ways. One of the things we asked them about, so this is the Healthy School point of contact, their training related to coordinated school health programs, and then the training of the council. And you'll notice that relatively few had any formal training in coordinated school health programs. And this is going to be important in just a minute in the data. The other thing is, what about members of the Coordinated School Health Advisory Council? Did they have training in this? And one thing I need to keep in mind here is, at that time, Indiana was one of the states that had infrastructure money from the CDC. They don't have that now, and so my concern is, what are they going to be able to do with a limited amount of resources and personnel? Okay, finally, what's happening? What about the infrastructure? Of the schools that participated in the survey, and for some reason, some just quit when they realized they weren't doing anything. Again, of the people who responded, we say about two-thirds said that they had a coordinator, and about the same said that they had a school health advisory council. But remember, the law says they're all supposed to have it. So much for the law. Okay, who's on? And some of them have asterisks, because the Indiana law was very specific about people who are involved. However, the questionnaire is actually created by kind of a combination of the school health profiles, a couple of questions from the school health programs and policy study, and then some work by a guy named Scott Rosas, who's with the Niemers Foundation, who's done some really interesting work around coordinated school health as well. So I tried to stay with what CDC is using in terms of their questions. So this is who's involved, and again, pretty wide participation. Not all the pieces of coordinated school health programs are involved, however. Second slide there again, role of school administrators. And again, given that this is the American Public Health Association, I would encourage many of you that if you're not directly involved with schools, get a way to be involved. We need you. Okay, so who's involved? Finally, if they were in Indiana, there's such a thing called a school improvement plan. And this is important now, because it's going to come up again in a minute. But about 54% of those that have a council said that they have goals in their school improvement plan. Okay, and that's going to be important here. Okay, in terms of their planning, some of them actually had written action plans, of just over half, and some of them actually had written goals and objectives. And this is important too, as we look at what's happening within the school. Okay, what are they doing? Not surprising, given the federal legislation related to school wellness policies, lots of things going on related to healthy eating and physical activity. And then, not just because it's Indiana, but not much going on in STD and pregnancy prevention. Okay, and then in terms of, if we look at this from a different perspective, this is more the problems, whereas this one is more of the initiatives related to coordinated school health program. Again, you'll see nutrition and physical activity at the top, and faculty and staff next in the list. And then you'll see some of the other things related to a coordinated school health program. Okay, the correlation matrix, what's interesting here is that in the Likert scale, those that had a commitment to the program, that was associated with the fact that they had some training. But also notice that training was also related to, there were a set of questions about their use of data for planning, such as the YRBS, such as the Healthy School Report Card that comes out of the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, all the kinds of different data sources. And the more data sources that they indicated, greater data sources was related to training and greater involvement in different types of training activities. So I totaled all their training, I totaled all their use of data, and we found some kind of interesting relationships. Also, their training was also related to the number of initiatives they did. And this is just adding up everything they did, and the more they did, they were more likely to be trained and more likely to use data. And then finally, they are also, in terms of training, they're also more likely to document what they were doing. And so there's some kind of neat things that says that what we do in terms of training schools and school personnel in terms of training is critically important. My co-author, Kristen, is running off to Michigan tomorrow to participate in training that's happening today related to coordinated school health program. This, to me, says that something's happening, but we need the training to have some of that going on. Okay, also commitment notice. Those that feel most committed also have lots of initiatives happening. And then certainly those initiatives are all related to training, their commitment, and their use of data. So there's just some interesting correlations. Again, not a lot of data. The other piece here that this is the SIP is the school improvement plan. Notice that that when we talk about the number of initiatives they are, they're also the schools that have goals related coordinated school health programs within their school improvement plan. So if they were being held accountable by putting health into their school improvement plan, they were also engaged in more activities. The other thing there is if they were making recommendations, and this one, those that were more likely to make recommendations related to coordinated school health programs were those, again, that had goals within their school improvement plans. And so more activities, more recommendations to improving the health of kids in schools when it was a part of a school improvement plan. So you can guess what one of my recommendations is. Okay, again, a majority, just with this legislation, the schools are moving there. The majority clearly isn't a vast majority, but it's moving there, and we'll continue to look at that. And that, again, a lot of those activities happen to be focused around the big push for federal legislation. However, some of you, if you've participated in your local community for some of the federal legislation, I and the school nurse and three students attended a local school meeting on this wellness policy stuff this fall. It was kind of scary. Okay, but then the other thing is Indiana has an interesting legislator named Charlie Brown. And we are pushing Charlie to that in addition to having this legislation, Senate Bill 111, to have a coordinated school health advisory councils in every school corporation, that every school corporation, this would be the next legislative piece, is to also include that they have to put coordinated school health program goals and objectives into their school improvement plans. Okay, and so that's that recommendation there. My last shameless plug, and this is another comic that isn't so funny, again, kids in school, is that currently we have, checking the color on mine, it's purple here, they're gray, so we'll go gray states and white states here. On another slide it looked blue, and I was struggling about whether I was going to say blue states or not. But in this case, there's not a lot of gray states. And unfortunately, there were many, many more schools that states that applied for infrastructure funding than who received it. And this is one of these things that I can do as a higher education person is encourage my legislators, my congressmen and my senators, to support additional funding for CDC so that they can do more and that more states can have a piece of the pie in terms of infrastructure money. And so push that one is really, really important. Indiana has struggled now since they've lost their money, and Kristen, just go ahead, shake your head, it's okay. To advocate for this type of funding can be critically important. The last shameless plug was, Sarah, the HECAT, last Monday morning, I saw seventh graders writing a prompt related to one of the functional knowledge pieces in the HECAT. and they were writing in their journals, summarizing the benefits of short and long-term consequences of using tobacco. And so, again, I'll encourage you, having the opportunity to work with the HECAT and the PECAT, get that into the hands of your local people, because they'll use it if you put it there. And so I'll encourage you to do that, too. That's my last shameless plug. Thank you.
Any of the four panel participants?
I have a question. In a lot of the policy analysis, one of the variables that was investigated was goals. So if a school has a goal, does it have to be a measurable goal?
The federal law doesn't actually require any sort of measurable goals or anything. And so literally, a district can say, we encourage nutrition education in the school, or we support physical activity throughout the schools, and that's a goal, and that's all it had to be. And I honestly can say I've looked at about 500 plus districts' wellness policies multiple times, and I can't think of any that have a measurable goal in there. So,
I actually have a follow-up question. Talking about a lot of the schools, you mentioned that some of you guys mentioned that there were a lack of a written policy, just kind of like a mission statement. I was wondering if you ever heard from a staff or administrator, well, we don't necessarily have a policy, but we have a practice. Because that's when I work with college campuses, that's what I hear often from administrators. Oh, well, it's just a practice. You know, it's a norm. We don't do that, or we do do this. And they want credit for that. So I wasn't sure if at the K through 12 level you also heard something similar.
We did hear some of that, for particularly with the districts that just had a mission statement or something like that. And one of the reasons why we want to be able to link our district policy data with our school level data is to look exactly at that question. What's the relationship between policies and practices? I could tell you, Lindsay actually did a quick analysis with our elementary school level data. We have schools that don't even realize their districts have a policy.
Right.
So, and that's common, the disconnect between the district and the school level. So it's something hopefully we can talk more about next year.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. A question about the Safe Bridge to School presentation, or two quick ones. One, you started the presentation talking about parents' issues about safety, not just in terms of getting hit by a car kind of safety, but in terms of crime, fear of crime. And but if you're talking about the non-infrastructure approaches to using these funds, I didn't hear anything about like positioning trusted adults along the way to school to like make it actually more of a safe in terms of fear of crime. Did the non-infrastructure approaches to safe routes ever get into that kind of safety stuff?
None of the laws address that. I could see where that would be an element of an education or a safety walking to school education program or some other non-infrastructure training program. None of the laws or regulations specifically address that. Just to have a manageable scope for the study, we purposefully did not look at predator laws because that would have been prohibitive. Too broad. But it is definitely a factor. I mean, as a parent myself, I know that's one of the main reasons that, I have fear about letting my kids walk to school. So it's definitely, something that should be considered. But no, we didn't see it in any of the laws.
Other questions?
I have a quick question about when you're looking at policies, have you been able at this point to stratify by are some policies being applied at the elementary level versus middle versus high school, with one preference over another?
Yeah, unfortunately I had to gloss over that fact, but absolutely. One of the things that we absolutely have seen, particularly in the competitive foods area, the policies that are in place at the high school and the middle school level are significantly weaker than what you would see at the elementary school level, and that's sort of what you would expect. but it means that we've got that much farther to go with them all in the high schools in terms of junk foods and sodas and things like that. We also see variability in the physical education, nutrition education standards with kind of a sliding, declining scale. They follow NASPE to some extent on the physical education provisions, but they tend to weaken once you get to the high school in particular, where they're not requiring physical education and nutrition education for every grade, every year, or things like that. So we definitely see variability, which is one of the key reasons that we tried to stratify our policy review by grade level. Marlene's analysis did not stratify by grade level, and so we found that there's some clear distinctions going on between what we're seeing at the various grade levels. I also actually had a question for Sarah. The trainers that you're sending out, you indicate, when you indicate CDC supported, was that CDC supporting the trainers going out or actually paying for the regional trainings themselves in their entirety?
Not in their entirety, but very, very close. What we focus on and how we advertise the workshops is we pay for the cost of the trainer. So CDC is providing the honorarium that a site would normally provide. So we cover that. We cover all their travel, their per diem, their hotel. And then there's anything that's related to the facility or food, we are not, we can't pay for that. But pretty much everything else, photocopying, other supplies, all the materials, we pay for all of it.
I can just tell you, as a kind of spokesperson for that, we've got Cindy Cunning coming to Tennessee to do FHI training next week. It's been the most blissfully easy process. So I'll
thank
just
you.
Tell you,
thank
it's
you.
Been great. Mm-hmm. I've got my garage full of FHI workbooks.
Yes.
Hi, I have a question for Sarah. I'm in nutrition, so I don't know all the nuances of physical activity, but I'm curious as to why the opposition to the idea of counting sports as physical activity, or why there shouldn't be an exemption.
You mean from physical education, if a student participates in school sports?
Right.
Well, the biggest piece that you would hear probably from anyone at NASPE and myself is that physical education is probably one of the most unique educational experiences a student can go through. It's education through movement, it's concepts, skills, knowledge that you really won't find anywhere else in the school curriculum. And what's happened is over time, historically, the 60s, 70s, and somewhat into the 80s, really kind of all of a sudden there was much more of a boom for physical education to be very sports focused. And the problem, that is not a problem if sports is integrated within a physical education curriculum, but a lot of times it eliminates students who are not athletically inclined. And so sports is very, very skill specific. And so basically if a student gets, does not take PE because they're in basketball, they're learning a very fine, small amount of physical activity skill through basketball and missing out on that big, big experience of overall a comprehensive approach to being a physically active person. And with, a quality physical education program, it's K through 12, it's teaching students how to be active throughout their lifetime and different other skills, goal setting, decision making, addressing barriers, creating their own physical activity plans. All that type of stuff is what we consider part of a quality PE program, and that's not what a student would get in sports.
So that assumes it's meeting the quality criteria.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a huge discussion about the quality of physical education in this country, but that would be probably a day's worth of hashing it out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Question about the vending laws. Did you find that some of the states maybe that did perhaps have strong vending laws, there were still problems with some of the high schools getting out of their contracts?
The question was, in states with strong vending laws, did the districts have trouble getting out of their contracts? What we've actually seen in the wellness policies is they're grandfathering in. And so they're saying, going forward, as your contracts expire, you must start to comply with the nutrition standards for vending machines. So they're, because they're legally bound, they can't get out of those contracts.
They may have a law contract.
Exactly.